May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of my employer, Carpenter Chartered. Carpenter Chartered is the petitioner in this matter, and I will begin with the issue of standing. Carpenter Chartered standing is established as both self-evident and as third-party standing. The concept of self-evident is, in the view of Carpenter Chartered, clear in this case because of the very nature of the practice that is maintained by Carpenter Chartered.
Mr. Carpenter, I'm sorry. Yes, just for purposes of time, could you just go right to specific examples of why you have standing or why your firm has standing?
Yes, Your Honor. And if I could begin with a generality, I believe that each and every client that Carpenter Chartered represents is faced by the procedural problems that are presented by each of the rules that have been challenged in this case. And that, in our view, is an important basis to understand that what the AMA did was to change the structural process and create a new set of procedures that all claimants are affected by. And each and every claimant that is represented by Carpenter Chartered is affected by the delays from these defective regulations, which we are asking the court to invalidate. Specifics of each are addressed in our supplemental briefing and in our declarations.
Mr. Carpenter, does it make a difference that Carpenter Chartered is a law firm representing legal interests as opposed to, let's say, some of these other national organizations we've been hearing this morning that represent the policy or the advocacy interests of their members?
Well, in one respect, I believe that it does, Your Honor, and I believe that that difference is that each and every client of Carpenter Chartered who has a claim with the Department of Veterans Affairs is profoundly affected by these rules, and that only enhances the standing of Carpenter Chartered because it is in the best possible position based upon its breadth of experience and length of experience in working within the VA system prior to these changes to understand the impact of those changes in law and the impact that these proposed regulations that are being challenged in this petition have. Yes, Your Honor.
Originally, you had said basically you should have standing because we should treat you as if you were in NOLA or PVA or the other organizations, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so that's the same type of argument you're making now. And when you say self-evident, I think, aren't you trying to say that it's self-evident for you to have standing as an organization, organizational standing?
Terminology
matters here because of the way the cases come down, and there's a concept of organizational standing.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, and in the context that a law firm is an organization organized for the purpose of representing...
The one thing you're not claiming is associational standing because you don't have any members, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, in terms of the argument you're making based on your firm, which I'll grant you is a firm of specialty, then your argument would go that any specialized firm that has decent range of clients would have standing to challenge any regulations of any agency that bore on their clientele. Correct?
That would be correct, Your Honor. And it's especially important in this area. The generality that you just described, I think, is true, but it's even more enhanced in the context of the business that is done by the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Mr. Carpenter, this is Judge Chen. Are you aware of a case in which a private law firm was able to establish standing through an organizational standing theory?
Not directly, Your Honor. There have been a couple of cases that talk about why a law firm should or should not be represented, and in the one case in which it was rejected, the court reasoned that it was more in the hypothetical range than in the realistic range.
Does that case have a name, Mr. Carpenter?
It does, Your Honor, but I apologize. It's gone right out of my head.
It wasn't cited in your brief.
Yes, it is cited in our supplemental brief, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
If it's cited, I'll find it.
Yes, it is cited, Your Honor. And as I recall, the basis for the rejection of the law firm having standing in that case was because the allegation or representation of standing was based upon a hypothetical or theoretical circumstance rather than an actual circumstance. That is not the case here. Carpenter Chartered has more than 900 matters appearing before the agency, the Veterans Court, and this court that are affected by these very rules. And it is not only the operation of Carpenter Chartered that is affected by those rules, but far more importantly, the clients that we represent and the impediments that are created by rules that create the unnecessary delay because these rules on their face are invalid, that they are inconsistent with the intent of Congress as expressed in the AMA and go way beyond anything that Congress intended.
Well, that goes to the merits, Mr. Carpenter. We might disagree with you.
I was only trying to make that...
I don't think your argument on standing is hinged on the necessity for us to find the regulations invalid. You're saying the regulations are subject to challenge under 502 and that that's enough.
Yes, Your Honor.
You don't need to over-argue your case.
And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I was simply trying to offer that as an example.
Let's take a specific example, however. One of your challenges is to 38 CFR 14636.
Yes.
That directly involves speed. We have a previous presidential case in which you were granted standing to challenge a regulation that impaired your fees, and your allegation in there was personal harm. So I would assume that you're making a even more specific argument with regard to 14636.
We are, Your Honor. And do you want to go to the merits of that, or are we still on the standing?
I just wanted to distinguish that you're not making what I would call a more general argument in terms of standing there.
Oh, no, Your Honor, I am not.
The person that is harmed is Carpenter Chartered, correct?
In the context of that specific regulation, yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Carpenter, this is Judge Chen.
Yes, sir.
Just if I could compare your challenge to this particular subsection of this regulation to what MVA was challenging in the earlier appeal as to the ability to collect fees for handling supplemental claims.
Yes, Your Honor.
In that particular case, they had a declarant, someone named Wells, who specifically described how he was precluded from collecting fees for a particular client supplemental claim. And so because of that, he was out several thousand dollars. And I did not see an example like that in your declaration as to how maybe you were working with a client or was about to work with a particular client, but then there was something about the operation of the regulation you're fighting against, 14.636C2C3, that precluded you from being able to perform that service and collect a fee. Am I missing something?
No, you're not, Your Honor. Let me try to identify two separate bases for the adverse effect both on Carpenter Chartered as a law firm and on Carpenter Chartered as the representative of other attorneys who have been in this circumstance. The circumstance is that this rule has retained prior versions of the statute in the regulation. And as a consequence, it does not affect Carpenter Chartered as much because our fees are non-withholding fees. In other words, we don't do our fee agreements under 5904D. We do our fee agreements under 5904C. But we represent a number of other attorneys who have had their claim, their fees denied under 5904D because they did not meet the prior requirements of the statute.
Is this laid out somewhere in your declaration?
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry. It is not. It seemed to me that was self-evident with the allegation that was being made, and if the court would obtain and submit such declarations, I'd be happy to do that. If any omission was a question of time and not realizing that would have been necessary and or appropriate. And
Mr. Carpenter, I wanted you to note that you're into your rebuttal time right now.
I was just about to make that observation, Your Honor, and even though I've not gotten a chance to get to the merits, I would like to reserve the balance of my time to respond to the government.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Pehai, your turn.
Good morning. May it please David Pelkey for the United States.
Okay.
Let's start with standing. I think that the key distinction has already come out right away in the argument is that we are dealing with a law firm here. And you know, one question that was asked is how does this, if we start down this path, what are we talking about in terms of application to other types of law firms? Is it enough that a firm defines itself as dealing with a narrow area of the law, represents people in that area, and now that law can become a super plaintiff to challenge rules or regulations in that area? So like if you had a firm that specialized in copyright infringement, could it then become a super in Title 17 rulemaking, for example? And I think no. And I think that the reason why is that when you look at the Supreme Court precedents that was cited in the briefs and you look at the way that these different forms of standing operate from constitutional through to prudential, the courts, especially the Supreme Court, express growing concern and wariness as you move down that path. And when you get to law firms, it becomes this case, if Carpenter is going to take the third party, I don't see it can meet the standard, certainly under associational. I don't think they're claiming that. Also under organizational.
Why don't we treat a law firm as an association?
Because the law firm is representing specific clients, companies, and those clients are the ones who have the issues, and the law firm should be can represent that they have.
Right, and NOVA has members who are veterans who have issues, right? In fact, that's the only way NOVA can have standing.
I think that characterizes NOVA's situation. I'm not intimately familiar with that.
Does it make a difference, Mr. Pelkey, that the way I understand it, associational or organizational standing must show that they have at least one member who would otherwise have standing? And to me, the word member, I can easily associate that within an organization or association. But I don't see law firms as a member other than their partner.
Right, and that's precisely the distinction I was
making. Excuse me. Can everybody mute their phone unless you're speaking? We're getting a lot of feedback here. Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Pelkey, as you were saying?
Oh, yes, thank you, Your Honor. I think, and that's the point that I was getting towards, and why I think third-party standing is really the issue that's probably at the center here with Carpenter. Clients are not members. Right. I mean, the wariness that's expressed in the case law for law firms proceeding as found it. It's not a path that we want to go down. It gets drifts further and further from Article III standing, at least in associational and organizational standing, the way they're described in the case law. At least there are members with direct harm, and that becomes a foundational element of why the organization is able to proceed. And I think that, you know, the bases here, so when you look at the declarations attached to the supplemental brief from Carpenter Chartered, it has clients that are, you know, advocating for specific harms that they think that they have. And so the standards for third-party standing are what should properly be applied here. Carpenter Chartered cannot meet direct standing either on an associational or an organizational level. And its declarations haven't really tried to. They're very general in terms of the harm to the firm. I think it was Judge Chandler's distinction between, you know, what was in this declaration from Mr. Wells versus Carpenter Chartered. I mean, when you look at Carpenter Chartered, they're talking generally about delays, you know, potentially for more work. Well, you know, you start applying this to law firms, that's any time there's a change in law, the law firm might have to do a little more work or research the change, et cetera, et cetera. And for this to suddenly become the basis for law firms to start leading the charge in the court to challenge.
So, Mr. Pelkey, what's the difference between what's wrong with treating a law firm as an organization? You know, there is a concept based on the Supreme Court's decision in Havens Realty, 455 U.S. 363, of something called organizational standing. You're aware of that?
Yes, and
organizational. Why can't a law firm have organizational standing?
Because I think that here, what we have in the case law from the Supreme Court is developing separate case law for law firms and looking at them differently because they are not organizations.
Read me the cases other than Kaplan and Drysdale that deal with law firm cases.
Right. We discussed Kowalski at length in our brief as well. And in Kowalski, the Supreme Court talks about, you know, the concerns that go hand in hand with prudential standing and looks very closely at, you know, law, the specific problem of law firms. And the reason why, I would add this, the reason why a law firm presents something that I think requires particular attention from courts on standing when we get into organizational versus third party is because when you think about what a law firm does, it's very easy for it to find itself in terms of, oh, we're going to do this now. Oh, no, now we only take clients doing this. It's a business that's working for clients, representing client interests, and it can choose to change and define those how it wants, and then can start generating standing for itself. Whereas, you know, organizations, 501c3s, support organizations, things that have, you know, clear mission statements, histories of you know, being involved in lobbying or direct contact with agency, not just legal representation, but other things. I mean, there are many levels and indicia that can go with that type of organization to help support.
Well, you don't deny that there could be a law firm, for example, a public interest law firm that had a mission statement that said, our mission is to stop the federal government from building bridges over rivers unless they can prove that it won't harm the fish.
I don't deny that. The issue is,
and you think that law firm should be treated like a general purpose law firm that has specialties?
No, I think that law firm's standing should be examined under the third party standing rules that have accompanied about every other request that I've seen for law firm standing, which is, look, you have clients, you say you're representing the interests of clients, if that's your purpose, okay, why can't your clients bring these clients? And so it asks, and the law firm can proceed with standing if it shows, look, we have all these clients, they have Article III standing, and they're hindered from pursuing their claim.
So let me just pursue that for a second, reading off of Kaplan and Drysdale. Kaplan and Drysdale posits that you have to have constitutional standing to show harm, and in addition, you have to meet prudential tests. and they put the third-party standing into that prudential test category in that case. So are you arguing that Carpenter Chartered here, if I'm doing the analogy to Kaplan and Drysdale, that even if Carpenter Chartered could show personal damage, Article III standing, or injury to its business from these regulations, it still could, if it couldn't satisfy third-party standing, it still would fall?
No, and I think between Drysdale and Kowalski, there's, you know, whether or not the law firm has to independently have Article III standing. I think if Carpenter Chartered has, can demonstrate standing under Lugin or establish its injury in fact and the other, it could have
standing. What do you make of Kaplan and Drysdale that says that it's actually a two-part test? Kaplan and Drysdale had to have personal standing, which they had because they could show they lost money was in the hand if they won on the merits. And then the court went on in the footnote to deal with third-party standing, suggesting that if they was in essence saying if Kaplan and Drysdale didn't have third-party standing, they were going to throw them out even though they had constitutional standing.
Right, and you see that in Kowalski as well, and it's mentioned more in passing in the early part of the opinion. And I think
that's why I'm asking for your help. So, I mean, you had just were about to say that if Carpenter could show personal harm under Lujan, Friends of the Earth, then you wouldn't worry about the third-party standing?
No, the third-party standing, it comes in, and that's what the Supreme Court cases talk about, is because the law firm is seeking to represent those harms, right, the harms that it's saying are happening to its clients. I think that's, you know, one of the key distinctions in the law firm context, so that you have the law firm coming in and saying, look, We're experiencing a harm here, so you look at Supreme Court cases and they check that one off, and we want to represent this group of clients and their interest because they're experiencing a harm and they're hindered from pursuing it themselves. So, I mean, my reading of those cases is that and it's not explained explicitly in the cases, but it's because of the representational aspect of the proffered basis for standing, right? The law firm is coming in and saying, we have all these clients. We're being harmed. The clients are being harmed. We want to pursue these actions on behalf of the clients. And that's why the court goes to, you know, that key step then becomes the hindrance step. Because it's like, okay, if you're looking to go and advocate these issues, these harms that you say are impacting your clients, why can't they do it? And so that becomes really the key, that's the new element, right, of law party or law firm third-party standing, is you have the typical...
Well, and your argument in this case is that Carpenter Chartered has fallen on its own sword because it's produced a large handful of people who say they can bring their claims.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and that's why I opened the argument with that. I think that the facts here, they line up with we have existing Supreme Court precedent here. We don't have anything going the way for law firms that Carpenter Chartered is advocating for, and the key element, as I just said, the new piece is hindrance, and the declarations eliminate hindrance for the individual claimants. So the preference is always for Article III. The party is being injured should be pursuing the case. That's the preference. Prudential standing is not a preference. It's not a preferred method. It's disfavored.
Well, Mr. Palke, your client, the United States government, has taken a position in an in-bank case that will be heard tomorrow. You've taken a position that the precedent that binds this panel has a standing requirement that is less rigorous than Friends of the Earth, Lujan. you're aware of the brief that's been filed, whether you signed it or not, the brief that's been filed in the in-bank case?
Yes, and I'm not sure how it impacts this analysis for Carpenter Chartered under, you know, Kowalski and the other cases.
Well, for the personal harm, we haven't decided yet. In fact, you almost gave it away. If Carpenter Chartered could establish personal standing under Liu Shan, Friends of the Earth, i.e. personal harm, you were about to say, well, that would be a very different case. And that even though he might not have third-party standing. So what I'm trying to say is, with regard, lay the third-party standing issue to one side and simply take personal standing of Carpenter Chartered, okay? What test are we, this panel, to use to decide whether Carpenter Chartered has standing?
Well, I think that, so if we're not talking about the attempt to represent the harms of clients, but Carpenter Chartered...
Yeah, I took third party off the table.
Right.
Carpenter Chartered...
Coming in,
let's just ask this question. Carpenter Chartered is challenging 14.3.636.
Correct.
Right? And it's saying, in essence, my challenge to 1636 is no different than the challenge I brought previously in a case called Chartered Carpeted, precedentially held this court, he had standing. Right? So what I'm asking you is, Carpenter Chartered's challenge to 14.636 is different from his challenge to the others. He's alleging standing as personal harm to the firm.
Right, and we conceded that's a closer case in our supplemental brief.
Now what I'm trying to ask you, I'm not sure you're dancing around me or I'm being unclear. Let's assume I'm being unclear. My question is, what test do we use to decide whether Carpenter Chartered has personal standing to challenge 14.636?
I think you look to the declaration that was submitted.
I'm not talking about the declaration. I'm talking about the legal test.
It's the legal.
The declaration.
It's Article. If he's pursuing, if Carpenter Chartered is looking for Article.
Give me the case. Tell me what case we are using.
Is it
Friends of the Earth, Liu Shan, or is it the DAV 2000 opinion?
I think it's Friends of the Earth, Liu Shan.
Well, what are we supposed to do? What you have conceded. Your client has conceded in the in-bank case that DAV 2000 has a lower, more looser, more relaxed, is your word, standing test than Liu Shan. That's how you have chosen to describe your view of DAV 2000. Correct?
Correct.
Correct. All right. So I'm just asking, you know, what test are we supposed to apply? We're a panel. We're not in bank.
Right. And I apologize. I mean, and I think we, you know, refer to that test in the briefing. It is, you know, as we're arguing in the in bank, it's the DVA standard is what should be applied. And that Carpenter conceded it.
The DVA standard?
Right. Our position in the en banc case.
No, you're asking for, in your in-bank case, you distinguish DVA, the 2000 opinion, from the rule of Friends of the Earth, Liu Shan.
Right. Exactly. And that, you know, applying that standard, that's what should be applied to Carpenter Chartered.
The looser standard.
Yes, I think that's the position we've taken in that case, yeah.
No, that's not the position you took in the in-bank case. The in-bank case is essentially asking us to overrule, asking the in-bank courts to overrule DVA 2000, correct?
Right, to put, right, in favor of Liu Shan, right?
Right.
Right.
And we're a panel.
All twisted around. I mean, as I started off, I think it's... As we said in the brief, the standard is the stiffer standard the that flows from Lujan.
Well, I don't want to pursue it further, but you're obfuscating, and I believe you're doing it on purpose, but there's nothing more I can say to that.
Hi, this is Judge Chen. I'll take a few cracks now. What would be a fact pattern in which a law firm like Carpenter Chartered could establish standing to challenge the particular regulation Carpenter is challenging here, 14.636? Can you describe what that fact pattern would look like?
I think that so applying Lujan and Laidlaw, if Carpenter Chartered, for instance, the declaration described a scenario, a specific scenario that resulted in specific loss fees it could identify, that could meet the standard. The problem as presented in the case is that everything is of a much more general nature.
Okay.
In the evidence provided.
So you basically are saying something like what Wells says in the MBA case.
Right, and I think government counsel said that it presents evidence, identified certain things that were lacking in it, but there isn't an attempt there to identify a specific circumstance.
And then what bucket would that fall in? Would that be personal standing or associational standing or some other kind of standing?
This is where I believe that in that circumstance, it moves into that's personal standing. That's an injury to the firm. And that can happen for a law firm, right? I think that the existence of third-party standing in the case law doesn't mean that personal standing is forever foreclosed to law firms, that they couldn't identify a situation that, is directly injuring or a regulation that's directly causing direct injury.
Counsel, would you argue that to the extent Carpenter Chartered has any standing in this matter, it's limited to the attorney fee provision argument?
Right, and I think as we sort of alluded to in our brief, that's the closest case here. That's I think really before the court. I think the rest present problems under the various standards that are more readily discernible.
My last question relates to the client declarations that Mr. Carpenter has filed.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand the storylines behind those client declarations, they are all stories that occur after the date the petition was filed here, the 502 petition.
It looks that way when you map them out.
And so what I want to know is are there circumstances where such after the petition filing date actions occur that's still nevertheless sufficient for establishing standing? Or is it your view, is it the government's view, that the law is very, very, very rigid about this and all of the actions have to have occurred before the date petition was filed?
I would take the more rigid view.
Okay, and why is that?
Well, and I think we alluded to this in the brief, that the problem, because what we're looking at right now here in practical terms is there's dozens of pages of declarations that were filed, soon before oral argument, and basically a motion to substitute in a footnote, and it just, if they are going to proceed on the basis of those declarations, there needs to be a new petition, and they need to take that position, establish their standing, raise their arguments, which could differ from Carpenter Chartered once all, the facts of the individual claim. And then the government has the opportunity to respond to analyze the arguments, analyze the evidence, and to brief a response. The current presentation of the issue is it's ambush.
No further questions.
Well, there's no further. I think my time.
Okay. Yes, your time is up, sir. Let's hear from Mr. Carpenter.
May
have 5 minutes, Mr. Carpenter. Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Carpenter Chartered is in a admittedly difficult position here, if I can be candid with the court. On the one hand, I believe DAV controls the disposition of the question of standing for Carpenter Chartered. On the other hand, this petition goes further than the petition went in the Carpenter Chartered case that was earlier. This matter is going to be addressed more broadly in the en banc decision tomorrow. I think that the panel should be guided with the existing precedent until such time as the en banc decision is reached. I just don't see any way for me to, on behalf of Carpenter Chartered, try to prognosticate what that outcome might be, because obviously the en banc court has the ability to carve out a rule different from the rule that existed when this was filed. If I could speak briefly to the question about the more rigid rule relative to the harm done, in this case it seems to me to be quite impractical to apply that rigid rule in light of the fact that these regulations could have only have had a prospective adverse effect once they were finally published. There would not have been any harm that predated the final notice. And then the brief window within which we had to file under 502 would seem to have limited that opportunity. I see that I'm out of time. I appreciate the court's attention to this matter.
Okay, Mr. Carpenter, we thank you for your time. We thank the parties for the arguments.